Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. This week, Thea's on one of her periodic holidays that seem to emerge confidently from the thicket of working life like a shaggy, slightly bedraggled dog.
She's not on holiday, can I just say? Hello, and she's not on holiday, she's working.
Let me introduce you first.
Yeah.
Indie pop star, arts editor.
Hello.
Hello, Lucy Dallas.
Hello.
She's not here, though.
She's not here.
I inferred that she was off.
Well, she sent an email saying I'm working. Yeah. She's just not physically present.
There's a lot of that. Is it work if you're not? If a person is working and no one can hear them, are they working?
She then sent us evidence of her work. Yeah, to be fair.
Fair enough. And also, I was going to talk to her about because Catherine Morris, one of our colleagues, says that Thea despises tuna melts.
She does for all sorts.
Did you know that
reasons.
As well?
I did know that. It's like a thing.
It's a thing. Yeah. She hates it that much
because you don't do fish and cheese.
Fish and cheese.
It's correct. And I think it's Italian. It's an Italian rule, isn't it? No, that's probably not the only reason.
No. So she doesn't have tuna on pizza. I don't like the way you have tuna on pizza, it goes all dry, doesn't it?
It's disgusting.
Right. It's not right. Fish pie has cheese and fish.
I think the cheese is hidden, so it doesn't matter.
I think there may be other dishes, which I'm going to think about over the next 45 minutes. And then maybe by the end of the show, I might have come up with a fish and cheese combination that's acceptable.
Please tell me that is not what you'll be thinking about for the next 45 minutes.
I'd like to be able to tell you that, but I can't. This is the bit where I say Google TLS subscriptions and get on board. So Google TLS subscriptions and get on board. This week, we have one of our periodic art history themed papers helmed by our editor Anna Vo. Freud, Bauhaus, Fabric and much more. She'll be popping in to tell us about it. And who's up for an opera featuring Jack the Ripper, focusing on all those dead female victims of his? Not
you,
me,
you
if
want
I'm
me
honest.
To say me? No, not me.
No, but we could be wrong. We'll find out. Because mm-hmm. Anna Pickard has been to see Ian Bell's new piece of work and will let us know what we should be thinking. Women on the Verge is how you've headlined it, Lucy. There is another opera review in the paper with a different headline that you doubted. Should we share that with the group?
Well, we have to now because you brought it up.
Yep.
Yes, because it's actually the title of a very well-known aria, but it was in Italian, and I thought, is that too silly to have
a Lucia van
le
Stelle, which is from Tosca. But I recognise that, and
well,
I'm not that.
You knew it straight away and started humming it at me. Yeah. So that's, you know,
so that's acceptable.
Fine, of course.
Yeah, I don't feel I'm as hugely cultured in the realm of opera, so I think if I've heard of it, it's in the Nessun Dorma.
But I think it
sphere.
Is, though, that one, isn't it, anyway? I wasn't sure, that's why I was asking you. And then you immediately hummed it to me, thereby proving that it was fine.
This is a test for, I think, if you don't know a Lucia van le Stelle, that means you know less about opera than me, which means very, very little.
Yeah, I don't know. You might like a different sort of opera.
That's true. All right, well, we'll talk about opera later.
Now, who am I talking about if I describe people throwing themselves off battlements and onto funeral pyres, killing themselves with their father's dagger, being killed by their brother, father, husband, or fate with a capital F, or dying of horrible wasting diseases, probably as a result of a life spent in poverty and misfortune? Yes, we're talking about women in opera.
Oh!
That's who I'm talking about.
Oh.
Perhaps the unluckiest set of people you'll come across. Or is opera one of the most misogynistic art forms,
is it?
As has been suggested? Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute, but we're not necessarily going to solve it, because that's quite a big one. But we are going to talk about a new work, which is on at English National Opera, composed by Ian Bell, to a libretto by Emma Jenkins. And the subject of this one is, brace yourselves, The Victims of Jack the Ripper. Anna Pickard has reviewed it for us and joins us in the studio to talk it through. Anna, many thanks for coming in and talking to us. First of all, just for a bit of background, it's a big production for a company which has been in a lot of trouble lately, isn't it? Do you think they have a lot riding on the success of it?
I think they do, because they're clearly trying to make a point about taking what could broadly be said a sort of feminist angle on probably the most misogynistic subject you could get.
Yep.
I don't think that they're particularly seeing that through. I mean, for instance, on the first night of Jack the Ripper, the Women of Whitechapel, I noticed that they'd left in place in the foyer the Golden Beaver statue, which was the... Yes, it is supposed to be
you
like
mentioned
that.
This to me, Anna, and I didn't know.
The Golden Beaver...
Anna, thank God you've come in and you told the Golden Beaver anecdote straight away.
The Golden Beaver in the current ENO production of The Merry Widow is the national symbol of Pontevedro, which is a made-up Balkan country. And yes, I think it's no holds barred with the puns on that particular production.
Really?
Yes, really. So the Golden Beaver's there in the foyer as you get in, and there's a sign up saying something to the effect of, you know, please feel free to pose and take a selfie. So, you know, fine, if you're in for that kind of joke, good, have fun. But if you're arriving to see an opera that is supposed to be about giving voice and dignity to five women who were killed and then mutilated, I would suggest that possibly you'd take it out for the evening.
Get rid of the beaver, I think.
Yes.
It seems to be a fair
Put
point.
Put it somewhere else.
But it's interesting.
Yes. Retire it for a bit.
You make a fascinating point about the title. It's an opera giving voice to five women, but it's not called The Women of Whitechapel, it's called Jack the Ripper.
Well, according to an interview that Jenkins and Bell did with The Guardian, that was a marketing decision. Presumably it's also a marketing decision that the hashtag on social media is hashtag ENO Ripper.
So it seems to me that this is your point about not seeing it through. Either this is a giving voice to the voiceless, you know, and you get this, it's a legitimate thing to do.
Well.
Or it's both again, trying to do that and also make a buck off the macabre world of Jack the Ripper, which is a big London industry. I mean, if you go anywhere around Whitechapel, people will tell you Jack the Ripper stuff.
It's incredible. It's had such extraordinary sticking power. I mean, it's really quite tedious, this ghoulish fascination. I think that there is a great deal of sincerity in the way that Jenkins and Bell have approached their subject, and obviously a great deal of sincerity on stage in the individual performers. I'm just not convinced that that's coming from the company. I think they're sort of trying to trade off what really are horrific crimes.
They're trying to be kind of salacious and tasteful at the same time.
Yes, yeah. And so you've got the salaciousness, which is, I think, possibly just attendant to the subject, no matter how you approach it.
Yeah.
The tastefulness, which I think is almost like a sort of straitjacket on the production. Sexual violence on the operatic stage, it certainly contributed to that quite a lot in some of its productions, and sometimes in productions where in source material, and I'm all in favour of taking the source material and doing whatever the hell you want to do with it, it will survive multiple interpretations, but to, you know, add explicitly violent imagery to texts where the violence is implied, that's become a bit of a cliche in the opera house.
And that happens in ENO and elsewhere.
Oh, and elsewhere, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But and you say in your review that a couple of earlier, the artistic director, he's done a couple of others, and in Traviata, he made Violetta dig her own grave, which you felt was kind of adding to the considerable amount of suffering she's already got in the opera, and also Bluebeard's Castle, I think, was set, is that right, in Fritzl's cellar, Joseph Fritzl's cellar?
Yes.
And again, Bluebeard's Castle is already, you know, already horrific enough.
Because we already know that the other wives are waiting behind the, oh, am I going to get the number right, seventh door?
Yeah.
I'm going to say yes.
Who knows? Not the sure. Last door.
And is that an issue particularly? Because, you know, you always think whenever you talk to people who are involved in crime fiction, it's always a female victim.
Well,
is that an issue with? I mean, are we sort of seeing the same problem through a different prism? Is that just the way that art has often worked in different forms?
I'm not convinced about this, and Lucy and I have talked about this quite a lot over the last few years, haven't we? Because it does always seem to be a female corpse at the end, but it isn't, actually. There's particular problems with this one because everybody knows what's going to happen. And it's funny that they're burdened by the amount of research that they've done, and they're burdened by a desire to be truthful to what evidence we have, which is pretty thin. So when it comes to the differentiation of the victims, that is quite thin. And where there are quotable remarks, they sound now to our ears, I mean, things like hearts of gold, lonely hearts, these sound like cliches. Yeah. Now, you could say, I love you is a cliche too. It's to do with the way that it's set up. So we have Polly, Marianne Nichols, who likes pretty things, a bonnet, I mean, rather like Mimi in La Boheme. Annie, whose defining characteristic is that she's warm-hearted. Liz, who enjoys sex, that's Susan Bullock. She gets to sing a nice number called I Love a Fireman. And this is where Jenkins does allow herself a bit more poetry. There's a lovely line about hands like warming pans. That sounds very attractive. Catherine loves to drink. And Mary, who's the last of the canonical victims, and I find even that phrase just so troubling. She becomes a sort of moral centre of the work in that she is literate and she wants to save her fictional daughter from a life of prostitution.
Is this because opera is by its very nature melodrama, and the thing about melodrama is it's oversimplified and it's often cliché-ridden and it paints in very broad colours?
I think you would struggle to find more than a very small handful of opera libretti that read on the page as great literary works, because that's not what they're really supposed to do. Opera's great gift, actually, is ambiguity. I mean, what you see on stage in terms of a plot or the words might seem like sort of middlebrow, even lowbrow entertainment, but the gift is that the words can tell you one thing while the music tells you another. That's not particularly happening here.
So if this had been redeemed by greater music, you'd forgive the characterisation more?
I wish I could say yes. I'm not sure I can, because I went in hoping that they would find a way around it. Nobody, no critic wants to go and see a work fail. I think that maybe if they'd done it 5 or 6 years ago, just when the boredom, I suppose, with dramas like, say, The Fall, where you've got this ridiculously hot serial killer, was starting to attract a lot of criticism, then maybe they would have got away with it more. Or maybe I would have felt less critical about it. Right at the moment, if you take this out of opera and away from works like, say, Greek, which is now, 30 years old, or 448 Psychosis, both of those had fantastically good libretti. What you've got is something that seems already really quite outdated, because if you go to the cinema, you can see The Favourite. If you watch TV, you can see Killing Eve, you can see Fleabag. And what you have there is women expressing emotions that are not considered polite to express in normal life. You can be rageful, you can be bitter, you can be vindictive, you can be furious, you can be lustful, you can just want to shag or just want to slap somebody, you can swear at them. All of these things are allowed in a way which, ironically, opera has actually always had.
Yes, and actually you can just think that they would do brilliantly in opera, because somebody would go from having a tantrum or something like that
into
an aria.
Yeah.
And actually it's those extremes. That's not the only thing it does brilliantly, but it's the moment when it's supposed to be that you can't speak, but you have to sing. It's the only way to express, you know, what's going on.
The action stops and then you dwell with the emotion.
But you can argue, therefore, that opera gives this an undue protection, because ultimately if you went and pitched to, say, ITV, we're going to do Jack the Ripper and it's just going to be the five victims. They're all going to have one characteristic, and then they're all going to be eventually knocked off in the way we all are going to happen. There is nothing other than that in this show. I'm not, that wouldn't get made now, I don't think.
I think it would.
Do you?
I do think it would. Because I think that what you have here is, rather than melodrama, you've got docudrama. And we know from things like, what is the phrase, responsible adult. Was it Janet Leach, the person who was present when Fred West was being questioned? I suppose what really, really troubles me is a simple murder, insofar as there can ever be such a thing, of one woman, or maybe even two women, is never going to be enough to be a story. If you add more women, I mean, I don't know if there's already been a drama about Steve Wright, who was the Suffolk Strangler, then it becomes more interesting. And I think we have to really look at what it is that we are interested in. And I think you find that in those autopsy photographs. Yeah.
Appropriate adult.
Okay, thank you. I completely applaud Bell and Jenkins for attempting to restore dignity to these women, but I don't know how far you can restore dignity to a woman whose sexual organs have been removed. This is described, by the way, in the libretto, in an autopsy scene, and whose nose has been cut off.
Your piece goes with a review, because there's a new book out which has actually done some historical research into the whole thing, apparently almost for the first time, and which shows that at least one of the women was not a prostitute, but she was homeless, which I think the opera also has taken on board. The book's by Hallie Rubenhold, and it's called The Five, i.e. The Five Women.
But I know, talking to someone at the TLS who's read it, who said, well, this is all being pitched to a market as this is recentering the women and giving voice to the voiceless, but actually it is another retelling of a story with a macabre sexual element. And whether on however it's pitched, whatever you might say, that's the core of the story. The core of the story is, let's prod around this again.
I'm not convinced by that. I mean, I haven't read Hallie Rubenfeld's book, but even from, you know, researching subjects like core operatic subjects like La Traviata, there is still a wealth of evidence about attempts to redeem the prostitute in Victorian London, attempts to demean the prostitute in Victorian London. I do think that for both the opera and for the book, to point out the fact that you've got vagrancy, you've got homelessness added in, is extremely interesting. Mm. And I think that makes certainly the book worthwhile. It's easier to tell that kind of research in a book than it is on stage.
The book doesn't have to be so dramatic.
The opera isn't terribly dramatic either, really.
But we know, because
domestic abuse, I mean, you know, most women experience sexual violence in the domestic sphere. If you don't have a home, I mean, you are vulnerable to anyone passing by. Well, and the kind of contempt that you see sometimes, you know, outside the station late at night towards homeless people of both sexes, usually addicted, as indeed were many of these women, to alcohol or to drugs. Things have not changed that much, and we've got a sex for rent scandal.
Yeah,
it's precarity.
But we are ending up, though, still with this myth effect, because Jack the Ripper, ultimately, no one knows truly what happens. They, you know, about every year someone produces another piece of often very thin evidence that sort of recasts another person as it.
There's just been a new one, hasn't
there? There's been another one, as a Polish guy was the claimant, and that got rebuffed fairly quickly. But it's interesting and indicative, and probably not indicative in a good way, that this story holds such a command on people. Why? Because there have been any number of serial killers in British history and in world history and in literary history. Why this one? Why does this one keep nagging at people? Is it what you're saying, Anna, that this is, it's because the women are victims of women and they're sex workers, and that combination titillates people even when they're pretending not to be titillated?
No, I think there's a combination of a fascination with old London that feeds into it. Ripper Street, the TV series, feeds into that, but you know, they have a sharp script, which is really good. I think it's the fact that the assailant, the murderer, remains unknown. Mm. I mean, the other serial killers, we can probably name them. It does disturb me, as it did in, you know, after 9/11. I'm thinking, you know, everybody knows the name Mohammed Atta. How many people know, you know, apart from those who are closely attached to anybody who died that day, how many people know the names of the victim? And I think that had Ian Bell and Emma Jenkins framed this as a requiem, perhaps it might have been better. I'm thinking back of John Adams's On the Transmigration of Souls, which was attacked at the time, a year after the event. I was at the New York premiere, actually. It was attacked as being maudlin in the British press when it was first performed over in London. I don't think it's maudlin, because I think that the one beautiful thing that he did was he taped people reading out the names of those who had died. And I can remember one of them still, and it's a message to one of the people who died. It's, "I love you, Dave Fontana." So, you know, maybe we shouldn't be too harsh on Jenkins and Bell, because at least we are remembering people's full names, even if they become... even if it comes with a sort of element of umpapa.
But how inexcusable then for them that this is called Jack the Ripper, hashtag ENO Ripper.
That wasn't the artistic decision.
I'm not saying it's them.
They wanted the women of Whitechapel, as far as I can understand.
Yeah. And also in the opera, I think we should point out that the killer's not in the opera. He doesn't appear and you don't see the murders, do you?
No. You get a sort of darkness coming from the pit. You get sort of Saul Ponticello strings. Mm.
I was going to ask about the music.
Cloudy activity. Yes, I'm sorry. We barely touched
all right
on the music.
With me.
The music is, it's very, very much on the Benjamin Britten lines, and that is not a criticism, and I'm not accusing him of pastiche in any way, because Britten wrote in English so very, very beautifully. Mm. The quintet for the five women is exquisitely written, mm-hmm. and it's been tailor-made for these five voices. You know, one of them is a rising star, Natalia Romanu. The others are all hugely established.
Yes, it's a wonderful cast, isn't it?
Vintage singers of their generation.
Well, we could talk about this forever, and it's so interesting because, like you say, the music's interesting, but the politics are interesting, the attendant cultural implications are interesting, but we'll have to leave it there. Anna Pickard, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
This week, we consider the everlasting male gaze of Lucian Freud, the painter with what a friend once called a round-the-cock work ethic. Ruth Gilding examines a two-volume monograph about this tactile forensic figure. "Each of my toes was having its portrait painted," said one sitter, which is creepy. An artist who never wished to relinquish control to those who might observe and critique him. The piece is part of our art history special this week, which coincides with an important centenary, that of the Bauhaus, a progressive art school set up in Weimar in 1919 under the directorship of Walter Gropius. It lasted for 14 years before the rise of Nazism and had this in its manifesto: "Together, let us desire, conceive and create the new structure of the future, which will embrace architecture and sculpture and painting in one unity, and which will one day rise towards heaven from the hands of a million workers like the crystal symbol of a new faith." So, fairly ambitious then. So, to talk about all of this, and maybe even more if we get time, is Anna Vo. Anna, hello.
Hello.
Before we start, I wanted to know how much, Lucy, you knew about the Bauhaus. I know Anna will have known a lot about the Bauhaus before this.
Are you going for straight honesty?
Honesty, yeah. I'm going to make this easier.
You want to make me sound good?
No, I'm going to make this easier. I had heard the word and didn't know what it was.
So I thought it was a school of architecture, I would have said. I would have said quite bare, German, possibly Austrian, but mostly I would have thought about the band.
Yeah. I've never heard of this band. Have you heard of this band?
Yes, I've heard of the band.
So good.
And what's the song?
You're possibly a bit too young.
Am I too young for the band? When was the band out?
80s?
Yeah, 80s,
I was too young.
Really good goths.
Oh, God.
Never mind the architecture. Yeah. Do listen to Bauhaus.
Well, I feel we've done the band then. So, Anna, you had heard of Bauhaus.
I had heard
Bauhaus, but I think you're right that it's kind of invisible as a notion, although it is, as all our reviewers have pointed out, just infused in our lives.
So it's a centenary, it's 100 years old, it lasted 14 years.
It was a school, it was an art school. It's important, I think, to remember the moment at which it emerged, which was 1919, and old Europe lay in ruins. Gropius, who founded it, and it was a state-funded school, had a very utopian vision that was going to beautify the life of the ordinary working man. So our cities were expanding, there was mass production, we were thinking more about the ordinary man. The bit that Gropius said before, when you cited his manifesto, he had a sentence before about breaking down the boundaries between the artist and the ordinary man.
So what does he mean by that? Is that to give credit to artists more and to our ordinary men and craftsmen, treat them like artists? Or is it more about the fact that everyone should get art-inflected products in their life? They should live in houses that have been beautifully designed. They should have products that have been beautifully designed.
How could we make all aspects of our life more beautiful? How could we? City life was banal and brutal and ugly, and how could we make it better? And there had been thoughts about that before, with, for example, the Pre-Raphaelites. And it's interesting that Fiona McCarthy, who's written this biography of Gropius, was also the biographer of William Morris, who was the figurehead of the arts and crafts movement. So you had the arts and crafts movement, which was a bit more nostalgic.
A bit more airy-fairy than this, isn't it?
Well, it was nostalgic, and it looked back to a simpler, more folksy, had a more folksy aesthetic, looked back to the medieval era. But that was before the age of the machine. By the time you get to 1919, you have had 4 years of mechanised warfare.
So this is modernism. I mean, this is modernism at its beginning, the post-First World War modernism. So the world has been destroyed, and this is the answer to it.
It seems to me also to be an amazingly confident thing to do of the German nation, which has just had this awful war and presumably got no money.
Well, they've got no money.
Funded to
That's the really interesting thing that actually none of our reviewers brought out, is that the school was totally impoverished. I mean, the students were utterly starving, as everybody was in Germany in 1919. They had no furniture. They squatted on the floor. No materials. And that probably had something to do with the way in which they worked, or the way in which they taught, the whole ethos of the school. This is one of the ways in which it is hugely influential without us really understanding its influence. So one of its principal teachers was somebody called Johannes Itten, and he had been an elementary school teacher. And
he was Swiss, wasn't he? But he's not a household name by any means now.
Itten isn't a household name. And he fell out with Gropius, and they didn't have quite the same vision. He was very anti-technology, for example. Yeah. But his teaching style, that bringing in whatever they could find lying around, bits of old wire, bits of brick, some soil, like you would in a kindergarten, like you would with small children, and just play with this stuff. So the idea of playing with materials, experimenting, just seeing what connections things throw up, that's really gone through all of our education ever since.
And has there been an aesthetic that came out of this? I mean, would we be able to recognise... I mean, there's a piece about the influence of Bauhaus in the West, it's called, in the paper, which is by Francis Spaulding, how Bauhaus influenced modern design and modernity generally. Do you think there is an aesthetic? Would we be able to pick it up? Or is it so successfully... I mean, almost the true success of influence is when you can't even see it because it's sort of entwined into every fibre. Is that what we're saying with Bauhaus?
No, I think you would be able to tell a very particular Bauhaus aesthetic, which is what we would think of as quintessentially modernist glass and steel. They produced a couple of very iconic pieces of furniture, which you'll see in all sorts of... You might have them in your house, like the Vasily chair. Everybody's got that. That was designed by Marcel Breuer. It's in lots of swanky offices.
Oh, have we got a picture?
That's not it.
Oh, there's another. We got a picture in the paper of chair by Marcel Breuer, which is like a lounger chair, but it's got lots of. It's very clean lines, isn't it?
It's very geometric.
Yeah.
That's not quintessential, I wouldn't say. Our illustration isn't essential Bauhaus.
My house is just filled with sofas with rips in it, so I don't really...
That's probably more William Morris, isn't it?
It's quite Bauhaus in the sense that's of it's a furniture very, of the people.
Yeah, it's a very dignified way of saying that's a very William Morris sofa. So who was Gropius then? Because at one level, this is an art school in Weimar, Germany, that lasted 14 years with Walter Gropius being appointed a young man. He then, it didn't succeed. Nazism rose up. He then left the country and went abroad.
He was only there until, I'm not quite sure, but there were two other people after him.
So he didn't even last the whole time?
He didn't last the whole time.
So at one level, it seems extraordinary that this even exists as a phenomenon. What was so special about it? Just because it was the idea of...
I think they were all extraordinary personalities, and they did all have a vision. And then there was the diaspora. They all took it all over the world.
And they all went and taught, didn't they? Or a lot of them went and taught.
And a lot of them went and taught and took those lessons that had been learned about how you teach art.
So basically, almost the rise of Nazism led to the diaspora. Because this was a country by 1930, it was already on the turn. That's 11 years into the school's history. So it was almost, by necessity, everyone had to leave and seek their fortunes elsewhere.
Yes, that's exactly what happened.
And that the way the influence spread. We have a piece about Joseph Albers, husband of Annie.
Yes.
See, I'd heard of Annie Albers, big exhibition, where was it?
Tate,
which was textilesy, isn't it?
Annie Weaving, Albers. Yes.
Weaving. How big a figure is Joseph Albers? It says in the piece that he had a fervent wish to be a great artist. And it doesn't strike me that the posterity has awarded him that. Marjorie Perloff's written about this in the paper.
Well, that's part of the point of the book, to remind us that he was more than a teacher.
This is Charles Darwin's book.
Charles Darwin's book. And let's consider him as an artist. As far as I remember in the piece, there is some description of the way in which he did use bits of soil and wire and make those connections.
Yeah.
That he used cheap materials and wanted to see what you could do with them.
Yes, so his father, Albers's father, had been an interior decorator, I suppose you'd call him, working, making, doing ragging and marbling, those sorts of techniques, which remained important. The idea of the materiality.
But ultimately, he's not as well known as his wife. That's quite rare.
I don't think that's true. I think,
really?
I think Annie is having a moment, it's belated.
Do you like her stuff?
Oh, I love her stuff, yeah.
Why?
It is emotional. When you stand in front of a one of her textiles, it just has this enormous emotional power.
Really?
Yeah.
I just find that...
pictures, her husband's pictures, don't have.
Well, they don't, and there's an argument, this geometric pattern... You know, because I was looking for the cover for...
Well, that's not what he's famous for.
So what's he famous for?
He is famous for painting the square, the homage to a square.
Oh.
And he did 2,000 of them.
They're coloured squares, aren't they?
They're coloured squares. If we're being honest. And they vary, the colours vary, and the sizes of the squares vary, and the edgings vary. Sometimes there's squares inside. Yeah. I mean, he did 2,000. They're not all exactly the same.
No, I mean, I don't wish this to become a sort of Philistine, how is that art question. I'm not going to say that. But I looked at them. You described them very accurately. They're coloured squares of different sizes. Is that...
Are you asking me to defend them?
No. So, what do you think? Have you seen any, Lucy?
The squares? No, I think we've all seen them. But we're probably really used to them. We just take them for granted.
Well, they're just
because I thought it was Malevich.
No.
Didn't he do squares?
He did squares too. Black.
Lots of
squares. Yeah, very,
very
black.
Right, I'm going to show you a picture of a square, Lucy.
So I didn't know. No, I know.
Let's have an artistic reaction to you right now.
I thought it was the same sort of thing as Malevich.
Lucy, arts editor of the TLA.
Well, this is radically unfair.
Here it is. Okay, we have now a picture. Lovely. So if you play along at home, you can just Google Joseph Albers squares, and the screen that you see is what I'm showing to Lucy now.
Oh, I do know those. I've seen some of them. I've seen, you see the top right-hand one, the blue and green one.
Blue and green squares. Now,
you will have seen them, because as Marjorie Garber-Perloff points out, there's not a museum that doesn't have one.
Because there are 2,000.
And because he made so many, that slightly devalued them.
Mm. We've got to move on, because we've got to talk about Lucian Freud, because there's a big book, two-volume book about his whole oeuvre, led by Martin Gayford. And we have a review by Ruth Gilding about this, Anna. And the suggestion here is that Freud is kind of preserved and cared for by a sort of male club of people, is sort of what Ruth is implying. Lots of sort of male curators and male figures want to preserve the reputation and legacy of Freud. Do you think that's right? And he's a very male...
Well, that's what it looks like.
He's a very male painter, isn't he? Extraordinarily male gaze.
That's what it looks like. That's except it's also obvious that he has so much female loyalty. But the women don't seem to be in the position of curatorial power.
To talk about it. Because this piece reads, at least, that he's a bit of a creep.
Well, that's what she says.
Yeah.
But he might have done it. She wonders if it was quite conscious, a need to make him... That he was quite naughty when he went to school at Dartington, which was already a very open and free kind of education, and that he knew how to manipulate people because he'd been his mother's favourite and was used to a lot of love and attention and knew how to get it and created an adult persona that was a little bit nasty. So
a bit controlling.
I was struck by the thing where it said, because clearly he was incredibly controlling of when the sitters were there, because he kept his attention on them all the time.
And drugging them even.
drugged them and made them hold onto animals and things like that. But not in it. That sounds kind of brutal. It wasn't brutal, was it?
But
it was
think
very
they
controlling and
it
quite
brutal.
Aggressive. But then she also says, but he also was kept them entertained. He told them stories and songs and poems and jokes and gave them snacks because he couldn't... He wanted their attention all the time. He had to sort of charm them and keep them on.
Even creepier, isn't it?
That doesn't make it sound any better.
He's a children's entertainer as well. It makes it even
there
creepier.
We go. What about the pictures, though?
Let's talk about the pictures. Ruth says, his genius reputation approaching that of his grandfather, Lucian versus Sigmund. What do we think about that? What do you think, Anna, where he is in the pantheon? Do you find him a... genius? He's now very high in the canon, I would
yes,
have thought.
Yes, he is.
And it seems to have got more and more so in the last 20 years.
When he said, I come from a really boring family.
That is not true, though, is
quite
it?
A good story, yeah. Isn't it?
It's a good joke, but...
They're famous in different ways, aren't they? But we know they're from the same family.
Yeah. But is he a genius, do you feel? I mean, it's very hard to bandy those terms around, but when you look at his stuff... I mean, you must have been to the big exhibitions that existed.
I suppose. I think he's a bit overrated.
Do you? Why is that?
Well, I much prefer... Ruth talks about the paintings pre-Francis Bacon and post-Francis Bacon. And I much prefer the pre, the 1940s stuff.
And how are they different?
Are they really different? Because he hadn't really discovered paint in the same way, so they're very flat surfaced and they're almost surrealist.
Yeah,
you'll know the ones I mean, that the figures have got enormous eyes.
Yeah, I know exactly.
She's holding a cat.
Yeah,
a kind of half strangled cat.
And then he becomes after Bacon, he becomes hyper realist and sort of.
Well, then the paint becomes
thick.
Much thicker, and and the paintings have texture, and they're much bigger, and. They're completely different.
Lots and lots of nudes, aren't there? A lot of flesh.
I suppose one way of measuring how great he is to think about where his influence is, how he might have influenced people, who's come after him. And there isn't really a school of Lucian Freud.
That's interesting. And actually, he's such a big figure, there should be.
Well, it just makes you wonder. I mean, there is... I can think of one artist, Jenny Savile.
But not a school.
But not a school.
That's interesting. Well, we started out with a school, and we're ending with a lack of a school. Anna Vo, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to the Annas, Vo and Picard, and to Lucy Dallas.
Thank you for having me.
Did you enjoy it?
Of course.
It was very you, actually. It was very arts, wasn't it?
Yes. I'm not saying what very you meant.
Well,
there,
no, you're the arts
minute.
Editor. I'm not suggesting that serial killing and.
I'd have been interested in one about maths and astrophysics as well, though I wouldn't have been able to. Help out very much.
Well, challenge accepted. Do get a copy of the paper if you can, if only for a spread in which we focus on Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and the Nomad Games, which includes the fiercely competitive event Honouring a Grandmother.
Sounds good.
Tough. It's a tough, tough one to win. Next week, sex robots.
You've been saying this all week.
I'm not invented it. We have a...
No, I know.
But it's a tech special. We're going to look at sex robots. We've got an extract from Ian McEwan, and we're also looking at Google and Facebook and trusts and surveillance capitalism. So it's not just sex robots, but I'm summarising it in my glib way as sex robots. You have to tune in for that. Until then, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.